This podcast was recorded at the 2018 JADPRO Live at AppShow Conference in Hollywood, Florida. To review the CE information and learn how to earn credit for JADPRO Live podcast activities, see the presentation material, or seek other topics of interest, please visit advancedpractitioner.com. And now, we're delighted to bring you this podcast from JADPRO Live.
Our final presentation of the day in this room is sequencing therapies in indolent lymphomas. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Lisa Nosden of the Moffitt Cancer Center and Dr. Philip Thompson of MD Anderson Cancer Center. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you so much for the opportunity to be here in this beautiful place. My colleague Lisa and I have the unenviable task of covering the entire sequencing of treatment in CLL and follicular lymphoma in under an hour, so I'll do my best. But some of the objectives we have are to kind of understand how we best treat patients with 17p deletion. I'll talk a little bit about some of the combination therapies that are now available, and maybe some that will be available shortly, and discuss some of the newer therapies in follicular lymphoma. Now, these are my disclosures. Okay, so moving into treatment of CLL. So we've really seen an amazing number of new approved therapies in the last few years in CLL. We've had second generation CD20 monoclonals. We've had ibrutinib, a BTK inhibitor. We've had PI3 kinase inhibitors. And finally, the BCL2 inhibitor, venetoclax. We now have an opportunity to see how we can best combine these treatments to maximize responses for patients. So really, there are two key biological processes in CLL which we can now target with our new drugs. The first is B-cell receptor signaling. CLL cells live mostly within lymph nodes, and they divide and grow mostly within lymph nodes. They get signals through the B-cell receptor from other cells and from soluble mediators within the microenvironment of the lymph node. And then you see a number of signaling molecules that transduce signals to lead to growth and division of these cells. The key ones that have been targeted are BTK, Bruton tyrosine kinase, and PLC, and PI3 kinase delta. We now have a very effective targeted therapies that target those processes. The second key thing is CLL dramatically overexpresses a protein called BCL2, which stabilizes the mitochondrial membrane and therefore prevents apoptosis. Venetoclax is a highly specific inhibitor of BCL2, which leads to fairly dramatic cell death. So the current first-line treatment of CLL revolves around either chemoimmunotherapy or monotherapy with ibrutinib. Those are the approved therapies that we have. And I've listed the chemoimmunotherapy options really in order of intensity, from FCR, which is the most potent regimen but tolerated only by younger and fitter patients, through to chlorambucil plus CD20 antibody combinations there. So what do we really want from an ideal first-line treatment in CLL? I think we want to see high rates of complete remission. Ideally, what we want to achieve, I think, is undetectable minimal residual disease. So this is minimal residual disease is when we look with a more sensitive technique than just morphology and see, can we see very small numbers of the cells remaining? And the less MRD you have, essentially, the longer your progression-free survival is going to be. We want to see treatment, I think, with limited duration. Patients don't want to take therapy forever, and if you have to take therapy forever, your risk of toxicity increases. And finally, I think we want treatment that's tolerable and effective in all patients, including older patients and those with comorbidities and those who have unfavorable genomic characteristics like 17p deletion. And so you can see here that we don't really see all of these characteristics from either of our kind of frontline treatment paradigms at this time. So ibrutinib rarely achieves complete remissions and undetectable MRD. And FCR, in contrast, while it can achieve a high rate of MRD negativity, the treatment's poorly tolerated by older patients and patients with comorbid medical conditions. So the assessment of patient fitness is crucial in terms of deciding on our first-line lead treatment paradigm, and I emphasize patient fitness rather than patient age, because age is not the best determinant of how well a patient will tolerate therapy. So for example, the cumulative illness rating score has been used most commonly in clinical trials to determine whether a patient's eligible for a certain type of therapy. So those with a score of less than 6 and adequate renal function as a GFR of less than 70 are generally considered fit for intensive regimens such as FCR. So just looking at the chemoimmunotherapy briefly by means of background. So FCR is a potent regimen which achieves high rate of undetectable MRD. It was the first regimen to demonstrate an improved overall survival in CLL. Bendamustine and rituximab, which is very frequently used in the frontline setting, was compared directly to FCR by the German CLL study group CLL10 study. And what it showed was that overall there was an inferior progression-free survival for the BR regimen compared to FCR. And there was no evidence of a plateau emerging on the progression-free survival curve. However, for the subgroup of patients over 65 years old, there was significantly less toxicity for bendamustine and rituximab with a similar progression-free survival in that age group. So it's certainly reasonable to continue to use BR in the older patients rather than FCR. Chlorambucil and obinutuzumab was tested in the CLL11 study compared to chlorambucil monotherapy, and that was in a group of older and unfit patients, and it showed a markedly improved progression-free survival relative to chlorambucil alone. And then similarly, chlorambucil and ofatumumab was shown to have an improved PFS relative to chlorambucil, and actually both of those studies had an improved survival. So these are data from CLL10, again, just confirming that the overall cohort, FCR, had a superior progression-free survival compared to BR, but again, no progression-free survival seen yet compared to in the patients over 65. So these are the data that I think are the most exciting data about FCR. So what you can see here is this plateau emerging on the progression-free survival curve when you get out to very long-term follow-up. So this is the original FCR 300 study from MD Anderson. And you can see that most of the patients that are on this plateau are those who have a mutated IGHV. So we've started incorporating the IGHV mutation status into a lot of our decision-making in front line. Because if you have a patient who has a mutated IGHV, you really have the opportunity potentially to cure them with your first line of therapy. When we go on to look at the impact of getting undetectable MRD, you see even a better progression-free survival for that top group in the blue. Those are the patients who have a mutated IGHV and have undetectable MRD after therapy. So really, that's what we're aiming for with our first line of treatment. However, the problem is, you know, this subset of patients that does spectacularly well with FCR is relatively small. These are data here from the German CLL8 study group long-term follow-up on the left, and on the right is an Italian retrospective analysis. And what you can see is that, the group of patients with mutated IGHV are doing well. But if you look at the data on the right, they really only represent about less than a third of the patients, with the majority of patients actually having this intermediate prognosis, and those are the ones with unmutated IGHV or an 11q deletion. But also what you can see here is the dismal outcome in the red curve, which is the patients with 17p deletion, and they have a median progression-free survival of only just over a year, and this has been shown in multiple studies of FCR. So really, what we're starting to do at our center is say, okay, if you're going to be on that blue curve, then maybe chemoimmunotherapy is still reasonable. If you're on the yellow curve, then maybe we need to start looking at alternatives. If you're on that red curve with 17p deletion, then chemoimmunotherapy is inappropriate, and we need to be using alternative novel agents. The other thing that is important to stress is it's not just about 17p deletion. So we need to look at TP53 mutations as well. So most patients who have a 17p deletion will also have a TP53 deletion. A TP53 mutation. However, there's another group of patients who don't have deletion of 17p, who have a mutation in the TP53 gene. And they have similarly dismal outcomes as shown here in data from David Rossi's group. You may not be able to see very well, but in that right-hand Kaplan-Meier curve, the patients in the red curve are those who only have a subclonal TP53 mutation. So not all the cells have a TP53 mutation, but just some. And what they found is if you give chemoimmunotherapy to these patients, they will inevitably relapse. And what will happen is that TP53 mutated clone will grow out at relapse and become the predominant clone. So we need to be looking for this before we treat patients, and those who have a TP53 mutation shouldn't receive chemoimmunotherapy. So what have we got? What other options have we got for patients with 17p deletion? So these are data from a phase 2 study that was done with ibrutinib, a Bruton tyrosine kinase inhibitor, in relapse refractory patients who have 17p deletion. And what you can see there is that although we're not seeing a plateau on the progression-free survival curve, we're still seeing continuous relapses. This is a dramatic advance on what we've had before. So we've got a median progression-free survival of 2.5 years. Compare that to frontline patients who always have better outcomes than relapse refractory patients, who have only around a 1 year progression-free survival after FCR. So really, this has become the standard of care for treating patients who have either a 17p deletion or a TP53 mutation in the first line setting. Although in subsequent lines of treatment, we've got other options, which I'll come to. So chlorambucil nobinutuzumab, this is the regimen that's been approved for older and unfit patients. So the CLL11 study. It included patients who had a median age of 73, and they all had a high comorbidity index or an impaired renal function. And you can see it had a significant advantage in progression-free survival compared to rituximab and chlorambucil and compared to chlorambucil alone, and it had a survival advantage compared to chlorambucil alone. So this became an option for older patients. Similarly, chlorambucil plus ofatumumab was shown to be superior to chlorambucil monotherapy in this group of patients. So what about ibrutinib? So this has now been approved for all patients with CLL, and it was on the basis of the RESONATE-2 study, which I'm showing you some of the longer-term follow-up data here. So this study again included older patients. They didn't include a comorbidity assessment, so it was just purely based on age. But there was a very impressive 2-year progression-free survival of nearly 90% if you compare that to the median progression-free survival of around 29 months with obinutuzumab and chlorambucil. And what's also interesting is that when you look at patients who have an inferior outcome with chemoimmunotherapy, those with unmutated IGHV or those with 11q deletion, it made no difference to their outcome when they received ibrutinib on this therapy, whether they had those features or not. So based on all these data, this is one way of looking at first-line treatment for CLL, and this is outside of clinical trials. This is essentially how we think about first-line treatment at our center. So the first question is, does a patient have 17p deletion or TP53 mutation? If they do, and there are no contraindications, we'd recommend ibrutinib therapy. Next, if they don't have these mutations, the next question is, are they fit to receive FCR type therapy? If yes, then we go on to look at what their other FISH characteristics are and what their IGHV mutation status is. So if they're IGHV mutated and they don't have 11q deletion, then we think chemoimmunotherapy is appropriate for a patient like that. And we prefer FCR unless a patient's over 65, just because of the superior progression-free survival, as well as the fact that we've never seen a plateau on the progression-free survival curve and potential cures from BR. And then if a patient has unmutated IGHV or 11q deletion, we tend to offer ibrutinib for those patients. based on the data from Resonate 2 that suggests there's no inferior outcome if you're unmutated or 11q deleted with ibrutinib. So there are some key ongoing studies in fit first-line treatment of CLL that could potentially change these paradigms that I've just talked to you about. There are two ongoing studies comparing FCR to ibrutinib plus rituximab, and it'll be very interesting to see both the overall results from those studies, but also whether subgroups of patients such as those with mutated IGHV have better outcomes with ibrutinib-based therapy. CLL13 is an intriguing study. That compares three different venetoclax-based regimens to either FCR or BR and could potentially bring venetoclax-based treatment into the front line for all patients. And then looking at the older and unfit patients, there are several ongoing studies that I think are important. One is the Elevate CLL study, which may see the approval of acalabrutinib. The Illuminate study recently announced that it met its primary endpoint, which is going to show that ibrutinib plus obinutuzumab is superior to obinutuzumab and chlorambucil. Whether the combination with obinutuzumab is superior to ibrutinib, however, we don't know. CLL14 also made an announcement recently that this has met its primary endpoint, so this will show that venetoclax and obinutuzumab is superior to obinutuzumab and chlorambucil. So we're now going to have the option of using a venetoclax-based treatment frontline rather than obinutuzumab. And then finally, there's a study ongoing, the UNITY study, which is looking to obtain frontline approval for umbralisib, which is a next-generation PI3 kinase inhibitor. So yes, as I was mentioning, potential first-line approvals in the near future: ibrutinib rituximab, ibrutinib obinutuzumab, acalabrutinib-based therapy, venetoclax-based therapy, and PI3 kinase-based therapy. So we're going to have a huge array of options for patients, which may make treatment choices in some ways more difficult. So what about relapsed refractory CLL? We have four approved agents in three classes, which are targeted therapies. So BTK inhibitors, PI3 kinase inhibitors, and BCL2 inhibitors. There is absolutely no head-to-head data on which order to use these drugs. There is data to show that a patient who has previously had idelalisib or ibrutinib that venetoclax works after failure of those agents, but we don't have data to show the reverse, i.e. that if you've had venetoclax you'll respond and failed, you'll respond to ibrutinib. So the study that led to the approval of ibrutinib was the RESONATE-1 study, which compared ibrutinib to ofatumumab, and you don't need statistics to see that there's a superior progression-free survival there. The long-term data from the phase 2 study have now shown a pretty impressive median progression-free survival in a very heavily pretreated population of 51 months or more than 4 years. And interestingly, it's 43 months in patients with unmutated IGHV, which compares pretty well to what you see in first-line therapy for patients with unmutated IGHV, which is why we're tending to now recommend ibrutinib-based therapy for those patients. And you can see there was a small treatment-naive cohort in this study, and you can see very impressive long-term progression-free survival in the frontline setting for those patients. Idelalisib and rituximab is approved in relapsed refractory CLL. So idelalisib is a PI3 kinase delta inhibitor. You can see that, again, this was a heavily treated population. The toxicity management, which Lisa will go into in detail, is a little more complex than with BCL2 inhibitors and BTK inhibitors, I believe. And that's some of the reason that the progression-free survival curve appears to be dropping a little bit quicker than you see with ibrutinib, because a number of patients have to stop therapy. Another PI3 kinase inhibitor was approved recently based on a similar study compared against ofatumumab, so this is duvelisib, very similar progression-free survival curve to what you see with idelalisib. Now, venetoclax was initially obviously tested in patients with relapsed refractory CLL. This drug has some unique toxicities, which Lisa will discuss. But it's very effective, again, in patients with 17p deletion. And it's now been tested in a less heavily treated population, so patients who are only first relapse of CLL and in combination with rituximab. And you can see dramatically superior to bendamustine and rituximab in patients at first relapse. One thing that I really like about venetoclax-based regimens is that with venetoclax plus rituximab, you have a high rate of undetectable minimal residual disease. So 62% of patients in this study with relapsed CLL had undetectable MRD after therapy. So venetoclax is now approved for relapsed refractory CLL regardless of 17p deletion. So it was initially approved on the basis of the study that I showed you previously in 17p deletion as monotherapy, but we can now use venetoclax plus rituximab rather than venetoclax monotherapy. Now, it's difficult to compare results from study to study. These results look better than the initial venetoclax monotherapy study, but you have to remember that patients on that initial study were very heavily pretreated, that often had multiple lines of therapy. They were selected to have high-risk genomic characteristics. So we can't directly compare. That having been said, you know, the toxicities are not significantly higher with combination therapy, and that very high rate of undetectable MRD gives us the potential to treat patients for a limited time period rather than giving therapy indefinitely, and I think that's a major advantage. Finally, looking at patients who've failed ibrutinib and idelalisib, you know, this is an increasingly difficult group of patients that we're going to see more of. Before we had venetoclax to treat patients who'd failed ibrutinib, the median survival for patients after progression on ibrutinib was about 3 months. So this study significantly improved the outcome for these patients. You can see a median progression-free survival now out to 2 years, and there's a very high response rate of around 80%. So how can, now that we've got all of these different treatments available, you know, which treatment should we give to patients with relapsed CLL? And it's going to depend a lot on what they've had first. If they've had chemoimmunotherapy as frontline treatment, you have your choice of these novel agents. However, if they've had ibrutinib as frontline therapy, then that's a different situation where you'd probably be wanting to use a venetoclax-based treatment at first relapse. But essentially, no randomized data. This is a recent publication from a multi-center retrospective analysis that basically looked at the progression-free survival according to which kinase inhibitor you received first. Was it ibrutinib or was it idelalisib? And you can see that the progression-free survival was superior for ibrutinib. And I think, as I said, that in part this is due to the better toxicity profile of ibrutinib. There isn't, however, any comparative data for ibrutinib versus venetoclax or venetoclax plus rituximab. So I think this is just a way that I think about the approach to treating relapsed refractory CLL. So if you're naive for both BTK and BCL2 inhibitors, you can use either ibrutinib or venetoclax plus or minus rituximab. If you're intolerant to a BTK or refractory to a BTK inhibitor, I use a venetoclax-based treatment. But you could use idelalisib plus rituximab or duvelisib also in this situation. If you have venetoclax refractory disease, there's limited data, and generally I think a clinical trial is the best approach for these patients, but it's worth a trial of ibrutinib. And patients who are refractory to both a BTK inhibitor and venetoclax are a very difficult group to treat and should really be treated with clinical trials. We're often trying to get these patients onto CAR T-cell studies. And then finally, I'll say that if you're refractory to a BTK inhibitor or venetoclax, these are high-risk patients. And if they're young and otherwise eligible, we're referring them for consideration of an allogeneic stem cell transplant, which we generally perform after we've given some salvage therapy, because the best time to do it is when they're responding to a treatment. Okay, so I'll pass on to Lisa now and to talk about some of the toxicities and management of these toxicities in CLL.
Thank you, Dr. Thompson. So we'll move into elaborating further on the targeted agents that he spoke about, and particularly looking at the management of these toxicities, but the key just being to recognize them and then moving into their management. Ofatumumab was the first fully humanized anti-CD20 monoclonal antibody. As you can see here, there are several FDA-approved indications dating back to 2009, but more so recently here in 2014, it kind of made its resurgence based upon the results of the Complement 1 trial that Dr. Thompson talked about, and particularly looking at those CLL patients that were unfit. The way it works is by it'll bind to the small and the large extracellular portions of the CD20 molecule that's present on the surface of B cells, even those B cells that have dim CD20 expression, which is the hallmark there with patients with CLL, as such that it's a monoclonal antibody, it'll bring about cell lysis. And the cell lysis occurs through the mechanisms of complement-dependent cytotoxicity as well as antibody-dependent cytotoxicity. Being that it's an anti-CD20 monoclonal antibody, we have to watch out for two black box warnings, that of hepatitis B reactivation. So all patients prior to therapy should have hepatitis studies performed. And then during therapy, if there's any suspicion for reactivation or even infection, just retesting the patient. And because we're further suppressing the immune system, watching out for progressive multifocal leukoencephalopathy, which is rare. However, patients presenting with any neurological symptoms, just maintaining that in your differential. It carries a very high mortality rate. Obinutuzumab is another anti-CD20 monoclonal antibody. It's got greater antibody-dependent cytotoxicity than does rituximab based upon the glycoengineering of the molecule itself. It's only approved to be given in the frontline setting based upon the results of the CLL-11 trial, which was approved back in 2013. And as Dr. Thompson was talking about, we're now utilizing these monoclonal agents in combination with a lot of these novel targeted agents that we'll talk about that are approved currently in the clinical trials. And again, the black box warning is the same for ofatumumab. There are some toxicities that we need to be paying attention to when patients are being treated with a monoclonal. Most importantly, tumor lysis syndrome. This is a big topic in hematology, as for those of you that are in heme. And this is due to the rapid cellular destruction that can occur when these monoclonals are being infused into a patient. You have to remember, CLL patients can have bulky lymphadenopathy. They can have very high white blood cell counts, sometimes into the hundreds of thousands. So based upon that rapid cell lysis, you can get electrolyte disturbances that can have clinical consequences from renal failure to seizures, as well as to arrhythmias. Infusion-related reactions are quite common, grade 3 or higher, slightly higher in obinutuzumab at 21 to 31% as compared to ofatumumab. Again, based upon disease burden, we like to tell the patients if we can get you through day one obinutuzumab, it might be smooth sailing from there on out, but our infusion center really has us on their cell phone dial whenever we're giving one of those agents. Hypotension, another hallmark of an infusion-related reaction. So again, just educating the patients to hold their antihypertensive medications on the days of the infusion. They can bring the medication with them, but to hold, because if you run into hypotension, we don't want any other medications on board that may interfere with our management. As well, they can get rigors and fevers for the patients with pre-existing pulmonary or cardiac underlying conditions. They should be monitored a little more closely just because hypoxia as well as bronchospasms can occur. Most institutions have their own pre-medication protocol, usually consisting of acetaminophen as well as an antihistamine. Steroid dosing can be across the board. Some places follow package insert. We like to tailor it to the patient. So is this a patient with high disease burden? We might give a higher steroid dose, or is this a patient that's had a prior infusion-related reaction? But if you're gonna start giving the higher dose steroids, you might need to prophylax the patient as well against PGP, if not fungal infections. Neutropenia, grade 3 or higher, can also occur in around 26% of these patients. Sometimes you need growth factor or antimicrobials to support them through. And again, because we're further suppressing the immune system, just paying attention to bacterial and fungal pneumonias as well as infections can occur. And then the reactivation of viral infections, we will prophylax all of our patients receiving an anti-CD20 against zoster, so they'll get an antiviral medication there. As Dr. Thompson talked about, we have four oral targeted agents on the market for CLL that just really came about in the past 4 years, so pretty recently, so the market appears to, as it continues to grow, it kind of feels like it's becoming the myeloma world as we start stacking things on top of each other and eventually be complicated like those regimens. But ibrutinib, as he mentioned, inhibits BTK, a protein important for B-cell survival. It's got broad approval from the frontline to the relapse setting, regardless of 17P. idelalisib and duvelalisib are two PI3K inhibitors. Those are given in the relapse setting, idelalisib given with rituximab, and then venetoclax also given in the relapse setting, now regardless of deletion 17p status. Ibrutinib has been designed to bind covalently to the kinase portion of BTK, and again, BTK is an important protein for B cell survival as well as proliferation, migration, and adhesion. It binds to the cysteine residue 481. That position is important when we start talking about patients that are resistant to ibrutinib with known resistance in that particular amino acid. Initially, there's a half-life of around 4 to 6 hours, and then with steady state dosing, you get 24-hour inhibition. And because it promotes cell death through the mechanisms I just described, one of the greatest benefits patients receive when they start on ibrutinib, and particularly if they have symptomatic lymphadenopathy, is a regression of that lymphadenopathy that can occur in a matter of just days. But one thing that's very important to point out to the patient is that we expect to see an increase in peripheral lymphocytosis just because we're blocking migration and adhesion. Patients get very concerned and start to fear that they're progressing, but it's not. It's rather a mechanistic effect of the drug, just the redistribution of those lymphocytes, disallowing them to be targeted as well as adhering to their particular niche. We tend not to see true tumor lysis in these patients. However, you can see hyperuricemia. The lymphocyte count may rise for a while. Eventually, it'll plateau, and then it could start coming down. The lymphocyte count may not normalize till a period of several months, if not by a year in some patients. So paying attention to uric acid levels is important. Some patients can also have flares of gout. And as I mentioned earlier, for patients that are progressing, you should go ahead and test them through next generation sequencing, looking for mutations in BTK as well as PLC gamma 2. And as such, there's clinical trials now actually looking at patients with BTK resistance, with one trial being looking at vecabrutinib. An integrated analysis was done looking at special adverse events of interest across the RESONATE and RESONATE 2 clinical trials. Those are depicted here into the table on the right. These are patients that had a medium time of exposure on ibrutinib of around 29 months with a follow-up at 47 months. And you can see there about 30% of patients during the first year had discontinued ibrutinib due to adverse effects, and about 12% of those patients had dose reductions. Most of these events, as you see, are low grade. The key to them is just recognizing them early and providing good supportive care or other interventions that may be necessary. We won't talk about the diarrhea or arthralgias in detail, but again, just note that they're low grade. The diarrhea tends to be self-limiting. You may see it more frequently in the beginning. Anti-motility agents or just good supportive care with hydration can be effective. The arthralgias can become problematic in our patients that have underlying rheumatologic disorders, which some patients with CLL, which some CLL patients in fact do. The arthralgias can therefore be complicated in the fact that, as you're going to see, just due to the risk of ibrutinib with bleeding, we're not recommending NSAIDs for these patients. So that's where I'm saying it can be a little bit problematic to manage those arthralgias if the patients have debilitating symptoms from them, and we often have to dose reduce to manage that. Hypertension, bleeding, and atrial fibrillation, we're going to dive into a little bit deeper just because of the clinical consequences that can occur in our patient population. But again, just noting that most of these events are low grade, that's the key, is going to be the recognition and the early intervention. As I just mentioned, ibrutinib can be associated with bleeding. While our ibrutinib has been designed to bind to the kinase portion of BTK, we have to remember that in the molecular biology world, we like to say there is conservation of conformation. So BTK is a member of the TEC kinases. So there are off-target effects from ibrutinib, and those off-target effects are what you see when you see these adverse events. But on the little cartoon on the right, just for simplicity, you can see that BTK and the TEC kinases play key roles in glycoprotein 6 signaling that's necessary for collagen-mediated platelet aggregation. So therein lies one of the mechanisms responsible for why we see patients with increased amount of bruising or even petechiae or prolonged bleeding. This impact is partially reversible after about 2.5 days of holding ibrutinib and fully reversible within 1 week. That data there alone tells us when patients ask us, I have to go for an elective surgery, how long do I need to hold ibrutinib? So for the minor surgeries, we say 3 days. For the major surgeries in that perioperative period, we say 7 days. Atrial fibrillation, something else to be paying attention to. Around 11% of patients can experience this. This risk is going to be present all throughout their therapy course. Due to these off-target effects, if the BTK and TEC kinases are important members to regulate a pathway, PI3K and AKT, which is a critical regulator of atrial rhythm under stress. So when you're thinking about the body up under stress, CLL patients are prone to pneumonias, so maybe a higher risk of AFib in that setting. Perhaps they have a history of AFib, so higher risk there, or even with uncontrolled hypertension. So standard rate and rhythm management is recommended, but just paying attention to avoidance of the CYP3A4 inhibitors during that time period. Atrial fibrillation is not a reason to discontinue ibrutinib. Things can become challenging and dicey, however, in our patients that have symptomatic atrial fibrillation. Is this a patient that may need a cardioversion, or is this a patient that may need an ablation? Because now we're starting to talk about having to add to their regimen one of these direct oral anticoagulants. It may be wise, and it's something that we do at our center. We are fortunate to have a cardio-oncologist on staff that's very well-versed in these agents that we can partner with to help manage these patients. So if not, the recommendation is to also partner with a cardiologist to help you manage these patients, because like I said, things can become a little bit dicey at that point. But nonetheless, we recommend to use a systems-based scoring system of, does this patient really need to be on an anticoagulant? Vitamin K antagonists are not recommended. These patients were excluded from the original clinical trials, so we have very limited safety data on their use. We do caution and educate our patients, I think, at every clinic visit against other agents that may cause excessive bleeding. And again, here comes the direct oral anticoagulants, the concept being that they do increase the risk for bleeding on our patients. And if you think about the kind of patient population that we're treating, they are higher risk in that sense. Some patients come into ibrutinib already being on one of these oral anticoagulants. Perhaps that's a good time to reassess, does this patient further need to be on that agent? Or is this a patient that now needs to be placed on one of these agents because we've run into an issue, perhaps with atrial fibrillation? So again, just partnering with a cardiologist will become really important during this time period. We talked about the surgery. I do want to mention one other very common one that we see all the time in practice is patients that go for a colonoscopy. We advise them also to hold ibrutinib around this time period as well, because if polyps are found, they're going to be excised out. They're not going to go back to do that, just, you know, in that sense. So we have had patients present with GI bleeding. So we just warn all the patients, just go ahead and hold it in advance. Same thing when you go to see the dermatologist, because they're always getting something clipped off. For any patient that presents with serious bleeding-related events, even though their platelet count is normal, the only way to reverse the effect of ibrutinib is to transfuse platelets. Some patients will wear a medical alert ID bracelet, or they'll carry a list of their medications in their wallet in the event of emergency, so the emergency response personnel know what drug they're on. Hypertension is something that needs to be aggressively managed. In these patients, the incidence of grade 3 or higher in around a quarter of them increases with time. So again, we have to counsel our patients to monitor their blood pressures from home. Again, standard management, but watching out for those concomitant medications that may interact. So in addition to monitoring themselves from home, again, we have to just educate for these patients to have a very controlled blood pressure. And again, if you need a partner with the cardiologist on that, it is advised, because again, uncontrolled hypertension can increase their risk for development of atrial fibrillation, but more importantly, the cerebral hemorrhaging. Idelalisib is the first PI3K inhibitor that was on the market. It targets the delta isoform that's unique to leukocytes. PI3K does play an important role in inhibition or regulation of T regulatory cells. Therefore, patients on this agent may have an increased risk for these immune-mediated toxicities. As Dr. Thompson had mentioned, the original frontline trials were halted just due to the increased risk for infections in these patients. So it's not recommended to give this agent in any patient that's treatment naive or an untreated CLL or SLL patient. Black box warnings are listed here, and again, we're starting to see these rather as a class effect across the board for PI3K inhibitors, but just to be aware of them. There can be hepatotoxicity, diarrhea, or colitis, pneumonitis, as well as infections, and then on the trial, I believe there was an issue with one patient with intestinal perforation. Select adverse events are shown here, based on results of the 116 study that was experienced in greater than 20% of these patients. I just highlighted by the red stars the ones that we're going to talk about today, the ones that are the most problematic and the ones that you'll have to manage in practice. If we just look at the grade 3 or higher's for those that received idelalisib, we see diarrhea / colitis at 5%. We're going to tease these two out in a minute. Pneumonia risk around 8% in these patients. Pneumonitis, something else to be on the alert for, at 4%. and then transaminitis at around 8%. Neutropenia can occur in around 37% of these patients as well. So thinking about, do they need growth factor or perhaps be placed on a prophylactic antimicrobial? The key to management with the diarrhea is to first just exclude that it's due to an infection, right? These patients are immunosuppressed as a consequence of their disease. They are in the relapse setting. So the first thing we do is we just rule out that it's not due to an infection. The next thing we have to ask ourselves is, what is the onset time? Because that's going to give you the clue. If it's an early onset diarrhea, it typically occurs around 2 months. It's usually your run-of-the-mill diarrhea, grade one, grade two. These patients can be managed with supportive care as well as anti-motility agents and very close monitoring. If it's a later onset diarrhea, if the patient's beginning to experience loose stools around 8 months, if not a period longer than that, it's typically grade three or higher. These patients may experience as well electrolyte disturbances, and they're usually hospitalized if it's not caught early enough. This diarrhea tends to be characteristic of an immune-mediated colitis. Important to note that while patients are receiving idelalisib all throughout their therapy, they need to be monitored for CMV reactivation. In cases of CMV colitis, there might not be viral titers present in the peripheral blood, so these patients may need to undergo a colonoscopy with biopsy to prove that it's due to CMV, because that's going to affect your management with an antiviral. But nonetheless, for patients with colitis, recommendation is to hold the drug and then treat them with steroids. The steroids can be enteric, PO, or IV. The initial study that was done with budesonide, which is an enteric steroid that some of you may be familiar with if you're in the BMT world, the initial study showed that patients treated with budesonide had a mean time to resolution of around 12 days as compared to those that did not. It took them about a month to resolve. But again, the patients do get better with time, but they're going to require a lot of aggressive supportive care to get them through. Again, just thinking about the kind of patients that we see with CLL. If patients are willing to be rechallenged, we rechallenge them with a smaller dose. 67% of the patients in the trials were rechallenged, and about half of them without recurrence. If it's a patient with CMV reactivation in that sense, the monitoring is therefore going to go monthly thereafter. Pneumonitis versus pneumonia sometimes can be a little hard to distinguish. Pneumonitis is relatively a rare event. Around 4% of the patients experience that. Patients can present with different pulmonary symptoms. They might have a non-productive cough. They might be very short of breath. It can happen very acutely, very quickly versus over the course of a few days. On all of our patients that are on a PI3K, the minute they come through the clinic, we make sure we get a pulse ox on all of those patients. If you're thinking they're concerned maybe for pneumonitis, they do need a good CT of the chest. We like to call down to the radiologist and tell them what we're looking for. Sometimes pneumonitis can be difficult to distinguish, or the radiologist may not know specifically what you're looking for. Some patients will require a bronchoscopy, with bronchoalveolar lavage as well. If your suspicion is pneumonitis, you hold the drug, okay? Median time to onset, it can happen anytime that first year, but we've seen it even later than that. So again, patients coming in with pulmonary complaints, just keeping that in your differential. The management for it, again, permanently discontinue or idelalisib altogether, but these patients may require long courses of steroids as well, and often they have a pulmonologist as well assisting you with that for a very slow steroid taper on them. The patients can go down rather quickly, so as soon as you start hearing complaints like this or through the phone triage, those patients need to be brought in for evaluation. Pneumonia, grade three or higher, around 8% of the patients. Again, they've got underlying CLL, so they are immunosuppressed, but now we have them on a therapy that's going to suppress them even more. As we know, pneumonia is an inflammation or infection of the lung. We often have to do bronchoscopies in our CLL patients. It could have been an underlying infection for a long period of time or something atypical showing up. Pneumocystis can occur while patients are on these PI3Ks. In the idelalisib clinical trial, it wasn't something that was known, so PGP prophylaxis was not mandated during that time point. From there forward, with all the PI3Ks under clinical trial, PGP prophylaxis is mandated in those trials. It is now part of the NCCN guidelines as well for those patients. Hepatotoxicity typically occurs in the first 3 months while patients are on idelalisib. We do have to caution our patients as well, though, to avoid hepatotoxic agents, you know, the two biggest culprits being acetaminophen as well as alcohol. It is managed with just drug dosing interruption till it resolves to grade one. Around 3/4 of the patients were successfully rechallenged. And again, just monitoring out for viral reactivation because, again, idelalisib is given with rituximab. Duvelisib, again, the newest comer to the market, approved about 4 weeks or so ago. It's a dual inhibitor of both the delta and gamma kinases. On your left is a little cartoon just showing the inhibition of delta. But on your right, that gamma piece, what it's showing is that the gamma isoform is involved in recruitment as well as differentiation of cells in that microenvironment that are supporting the B cell survival. It also serves there to be with immunosuppression as well. Black box warnings, what we're seeing again across the board for the PI3Ks. Some select adverse events are shown here. Again, no new safety signals than with what we saw compared to idelalisib, except here in the DUO study, diarrhea and colitis were teased out because after we learned from the first experience, they knew what to look for. So colitis, grade 3 or higher, can occur in around 12% of these patients. Again, the same timing story holds true when you're looking for these potential toxicities. Venetoclax, this one is unique in the sense that it binds to BCL2. BCL2 is a protein that is overexpressed in several hematologic malignancies, in particular in the case of CLL, which makes these lymphocytes look like they have these very long, eternal life cycles, because BCL2 will sequester away these proteins that are involved in cell death. When venetoclax binds to BCL2, it'll sequester it away. Those pro-apoptotic proteins are then free to go about and do their job function and initiate the caspase cascade, and you bring about cell death. This occurs independent of the TP53 pathway, but just the mechanism alone is why you see the tumor lysis. It's got two FDA-approved indications, both in the relapse setting, regardless of 17P. The biggest contraindication is during that 5-week ramp-up period to avoid any strong CYP3A inhibitors. Before venetoclax was on the market, when it was called ABT-199, that ramp-up period was over the course of about 3 weeks or so. And with that shorter ramp-up period, they actually saw more cases of tumor lysis syndrome that had clinical consequences. The ramp-up period now is over the course of 5 weeks, but it really must be strictly adhered to. Special adverse events of interest. We know patients with CLL can just on their own develop autoimmune hemolytic anemias. However, as a monotherapy, it was seen in around 7% of these patients. Myelosuppression is something to watch out for. Grade 3 or higher neutropenias, around 64%. Again, the patients may require growth factors to support them through. GI disturbances, diarrhea, nausea, around 40%. Those tend to be self-limiting as well. The diarrhea can be managed with anti-motility agents. You tend to see it if you're going to see it during the initial ramp-up period. Nausea as well can be there. Most patients that we see that develop this, again, don't require an antiemetic, but it seems to be when they go from the 200 to the 400 milligram dosing if you're going to see it. They do take it with food or water, and it is recommended. Also recommended to take it with a low-fat meal. Higher fat meals can increase the absorption of Venclexta. Infection, we see it across the board just because they have CLL, but the risk for pneumonia, grade 3 at 9%. And then grade 3 or higher laboratory evidence of tumor lysis syndrome is around 3 to 6%. The key to the tumor lysis risk is just profiling the patient from the get-go. On the bottom right is a cartoon just showing that 5-week ramp-up. Those first 4 weeks, that particular dosing goes for 7 days straight. It's recommended that they do not skip any of the doses, that they actually complete each ramp up as indicated. I won't go through this in detail. It's very nicely laid out in the package insert, but all patients need to have a CT prior to the start of therapy. You need to know those lymph node sizes. And then of course we have the lymphocyte count in the peripheral blood. Based on those two factors alone, you can place your patient into low, medium, or high risk. Low and medium, you can treat them outpatient. All the high-risk patients are admitted for the day one as well as the day 8 dosing. And then as you can see, there are some post-dosing labs that'll come along with that day 1 and day 8. The big key there with giving Venclexta is just sitting the patient down and having them understand that for those first 5 weeks, they're very committed to coming into your office during that time point. So in summary, infusion-related reactions, they are manageable events, but they're inherent to ofatumumab and obinutuzumab as a mechanism of their job function. Patients receiving ibrutinib should be counseled as well as monitored closely for bleeding-related events as well as cardiac-related events. You may need to refer them to a cardiologist to assist you. All patients receiving idelalisib need to be counseled on the diarrhea as well as the infection risk on when to report. And then venetoclax has a very favorable risk-benefit profile, but just the key to giving that drug is just patient profiling before you start that 5-week ramp-up course. And then, of course, because we are seeing so many oral oncolytics that continue to come out on the market just across the oncology world, and these drugs come from specialty pharmacies, the patient really needs to maintain an accurate medication profile with whatever pharmacy they may be using, because we see it very commonly in clinical practice. They come in and there's a new medication on board, but because we're talking about some pretty life-threatening events with patients here, the interaction checks need to be performed. Okay, so next we'll move into the treatment of follicular lymphoma.
Okay, thank you. So follicular lymphoma is a little bit different from CLL. They're both indolent lymphomas, but the treatment remains significantly different. And one of the major points of difference is that we really haven't seen quite the same explosion of novel therapies in follicular lymphoma. And in particular, in the first line setting, we still have chemoimmunotherapy as the basis of treatment. So just a little initial map for how to manage frontline treatment of follicular lymphoma. There's a small group of patients that present with localized disease, stage 1 to 2. Those patients are potentially curable with radiotherapy, but radiotherapy has some toxicity, so we generally only give that to people if we think that they're going to live at least 15 years. Most patients, however, present with advanced stage disease. If they're asymptomatic, they can be safely observed. Similar to what we do with a watch and wait phase of CLL. If they're symptomatic, we can treat them with chemoimmunotherapy, and that's usually with R-CHOP, R-CVP, or R-bendamustine. And then subsequently, there's a decision to be made about whether or not to give rituximab maintenance. The reason for the watch and wait for a subgroup of asymptomatic patients with follicular lymphoma is that there's never been a survival benefit shown for early treatment of patients. So this is, again, like CLL, is theoretically an incurable disease. So we wait for them to fulfill what we call the GELF criteria, usually to start treatment. And this is based on bulky lymphadenopathy, systemic symptoms, very large spleen, particularly if it's causing compression of the stomach and patients are unable to eat. If they have pleural or peritoneal effusions, or if they have a significant circulating disease. And then finally, if they have cytopenias. So what about the choice of chemoimmunotherapy? So this is still a little bit controversial. So there was a non-inferiority study called the STILL study, which compared bendamustine rituximab to R-CHOP, and that included both a number of histologies, including follicular lymphoma. It showed a superior progression-free survival for bendamustine compared to R-CHOP, including when they just analyzed the follicular lymphoma patients. However, additionally, the bendamustine rituximab had a lower rate of myelosuppression, a lower infection rate. It doesn't cause peripheral neuropathy, and it didn't cause hair loss. So there were some advantages to the bendamustine rituximab therapy. Now, why do we not just do BR for everybody? Well, one of the problems is that there was a dramatic improvement in outcomes for patients who received rituximab maintenance after R-CHOP. And we don't really know whether that same benefit is achieved after bendamustine rituximab. Additionally, there's another study that I'll talk about called the Gallium study, which compared a rituximab and chemotherapy to obinutuzumab and chemotherapy. And that actually showed a higher rate of fatal adverse events in older patients receiving bendamustine in both the rituximab and the obinutuzumab-containing arms. So really, either of those treatments remains a reasonable choice. Generally, though, for very elderly patients and patients with comorbidities, you'd look at a less intensive regimen like RCVP or even rituximab monotherapy. So this is the Gallium study. As I was saying, comparison of R chemo to G chemo, and then maintenance treatment for 2 years for both of them. These are the progression-free survival results. So this was a plenary session at ASH in, I think, 2016. Overall, a superior progression-free survival for the obinutuzumab-treated arm. And that held true regardless of what chemotherapy regimen you can see here, as you can see here. The obinutuzumab-treated arm was associated with higher rate of infusion-related reactions, higher rate of febrile neutropenia, and there was a higher cumulative incidence of grade 3-4 infection. And I'll stress there's no overall survival benefit for this scene yet. Progression within 24 years, this POD24 is something you'll hear a lot in follicular lymphoma. This is an important milestone because essentially if you receive, say, R-CHOP and you progress within 24 months, your prognosis is extremely poor. So they looked at what was the incidence of POD24 according to treatment arm in the gallium study, and it was lower, significantly lower in the group who received obinutuzumab. So when we're choosing the monoclonal antibody, rituximab is essentially less toxic, it has lower cost, and later I'll show that if you become rituximab refractory, you may be able to be salvaged with obinutuzumab. Whereas with obinutuzumab, it's a more potent drug, there are more patients who get undetectable MRD, and it does have a superior progression-free survival, as well as that reduction in POD24. So again, either may well remain a reasonable choice. So this is the PRIMA study, which was the major study that led to this concept of rituximab maintenance in follicular lymphoma. So again, patients received initial chemoimmunotherapy, rituximab-based chemoimmunotherapy, and then 2 years of rituximab maintenance afterwards. And you can see significant improvement in progression-free survival, and actually the 10-year follow-up was presented at ASH last year, and it remains a highly significant difference between the two treatment arms. However, there's still no overall survival benefit even when you follow patients out to 10 years. In a separate study, they looked at the risk of transformation to diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, and they compared patients who did and did not receive rituximab maintenance, and there was a small absolute risk reduction for transformation at 10 years in those patients who received maintenance rituximab. So when we're deciding on whether or not to give maintenance rituximab, I think several things to consider. One, what chemotherapy did they get? We don't know if it's beneficial after bendamustine rituximab. How well did they tolerate induction? There is this very small reduction in the risk of histologic transformation, which is obviously a desirable thing. But again, important to stress, no survival benefit from rituximab maintenance. So what about relapse refractory follicular lymphoma? So again, this is the data that shows that progression or death within 24 months. And you can see if you progress within 2 years of R-CHOP, which is the red line, your outcome is very poor overall. And so this is the group of patients where we really need to be particularly focused on ways that we can improve outcome. So this is a kind of a complex slide, and I'm indebted to my colleague Chan Chia for providing this slide. So the way we think about these patients, first of all, do they need treatment? There may be the opportunity to do surveillance. And if they need treatment, the next thing is, are they in this high-risk group where they progressed within 24 months? If they're not, then essentially they get another round of chemoimmunotherapy. And that's chosen essentially based on the patient, their characteristics, and what they received before. If they don't respond to a second round of chemoimmunotherapy, then we need to be considering clinical trials or one of the novel agents I'll discuss later. If they were a poor prognosis patient and progressed within 24 months, these are the type of patients where we may look to do an autologous transplant if they have a chemosensitive relapse. So this is the Gadolin study. So this was a group of patients who were rituximab refractory, another poor prognosis group of patients with follicular lymphoma. And they were randomized to receive either bendamustine alone or bendamustine with obinutuzumab and then obinutuzumab maintenance. And this study showed a significant progression-free survival benefit for the obinutuzumab arm. So this is definitely an option for patients who've failed rituximab-based therapy. The other group of agents that have been approved in follicular lymphoma are the PI3 kinase inhibitors. So unlike CLL, we've not seen significant benefit from BTK inhibitors or BCL2 inhibitors, which was surprising given that BCL2 is dramatically overexpressed in follicular lymphoma as a result of a hallmark chromosomal translocation. So the PI3 kinase delta inhibitors, in contrast, have shown benefit in follicular lymphoma. So this is the study that led to the approval of idelalisib. You can see from this waterfall plot that more than half of the patients achieved a partial response. These are patients who are refractory to two lines of therapy, and a relatively low rate of complete remission. They have a progression-free survival benefit of under a year. But one thing that was interesting was that their progression-free survival after idelalisib was actually better than their progression-free survival from their previous therapy. Copanlisib is a dual inhibitor of PI3 kinase alpha and delta, and similarly to idelalisib, it was tested in patients who'd failed at least two lines of therapy and showed a similar progression-free survival result. And then finally, duvelisib, which is a PI3 kinase delta and gamma inhibitor and is also approved in CLL, has been tested in that same high-risk group of patients with an overall response rate of just under 50% in follicular lymphoma and progression-free survival of around 8 months. So you can see, compared to, say, venetoclax and rituximab in CLL or ibrutinib in CLL, we're really having relatively a short progression-free survival in follicular lymphoma of around a year once we're down to our second relapse. So definitely still some work to be done. So just to summarize that, approximately 20% of patients relapse within 2 years and are refractory to therapy, resulting in a 5-year overall survival of less than 50%. The really high-risk patients are the ones who relapse within 2 years after rituximab and alkylating agents, and they have limited treatment options, and really we need clinical trials for these patients. As I mentioned, there's very limited efficacy for BCL2 inhibitors or BTK inhibitors, unlike CLL, so novel therapies in follicular lymphoma are urgently needed, for example, CAR T cells. And then finally, I'll hand back to Lisa to discuss the AEs of some of these drugs.
Okay. We're on the home stretch, I promise. I know we're standing between you and dinner. Okay, so our final slide is that with looking at adverse events of interest in copanlisib. We won't discuss the other ones for duvelisib and idelalisib because they're, again, roughly similar. But copanlisib is the dual inhibitor, as he mentioned, of both alpha and delta. So you'll get the same toxicities with the delta isoform. What's new here is the toxicities attributable to the alpha isoform, and that in particular is the hyperglycemia as well as the hypertension. These tend to be transient, but because the drug is given once a week, 3 weeks on, 1 week off, this drug is, these patients need to have controlled blood pressures as well as be controlled in terms of their glucose levels, so maybe not an agent of choice for an uncontrolled diabetic or a patient with uncontrolled hypertension. The hyperglycemia tends to be transient. Grade 3 incidence of higher is 41%. More so 5 to 8 hours post the infusion of the drug, but also can may last up to 24 hours after the drug. So again, the patient needs to have a controlled blood glucose level prior to administration of this drug. And then again, with the hypertension, grade 3 or higher in around a quarter of these patients. So again, blood pressure needs to be controlled. The other signals that we see down there, though, the transaminitis as well as the neutropenia and lung infections, similar across the board to what we saw for the other PI3K inhibitors. But these two particular side effects that I just brought up now, something to pay attention to in the patient in terms of profiling the patient, maybe if you're thinking that they may or may not be adequate here. And as I promised, that was the last slide.